Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Hey, everyone. It's Asten Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what The New York Times has been doing for more than a century, and that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your organic lab machine creation of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
Times, Europe Express. Times, Europe Express. Times, Europe Express. Times, Europe Express.
We are going this week from Lagos to Dusseldorf. In the last couple weeks, we have lost both Tony Allen, who was a tremendous drummer and drummed with Fela in the 70s and Africa 70, and had a long career after he and Fela parted ways, and also Florian Schneider, who's one half of Kraftwerk. And I was thinking a lot about the parallel legacies of these musicians, how during the same time period, they basically took cues from the rock and funk and jazz that they were presented with and innovated entirely new original approaches to funk, to rhythm, to drums, to texture, and to energy. And there are people who are smarter than I about those things. And so I wanted to have a conversation this week about these two musicians, where they drew their influences from, what they ended up influencing, and these two styles that in a lot of ways are oppositional, but maybe have some consonances. And we're going to talk about the kind of unexpected points of overlap between the two of them. So we're going to have two chats this week. John Pareles is going to call in first. You know JP, chief pop music critic in the New York Times. And then we're going to follow up with Joseph Patel, who is a former music journalist, current film and television producer, who was one of the writers that I grew up reading and who would write about the influence of artists like Allen and Schneider on hip hop and beyond. So first up, here's John Pareles calling in. JP.
Hey there.
I know you're there with the Twitch headset. Coming in first person shooter on this week episode of podcast. I appreciate it. So JP, I don't want to dwell too much on the kind of density of death and tragedy that the music business and music lovers have had to go through in the last few weeks because of coronavirus. It's been pretty overwhelming. But I was struck last week when we found out that Tony Allen had died and that Florian Schneider had died. I was struck, and I should say neither of Corona from what we know.
Right.
But I was struck by how parallel their paths were from a timing perspective and from a funk perspective. They seem to be telling two parallel stories about drums and about rhythm. And I thought it might be instructive to talk about them independently and maybe also a little bit in conversation with each other.
Well, the question, John, though, is were you struck like a drumhead or were you struck like a drum machine pad?
Ooh, that's a fair question. I think probably I was struck as if by a trombone across the side of the head.
There
so neither. Let's start with Tony Allen. who I actually did have the fortune to see in the 2000s. I had the fortune to see him live. Tony Allen, talk us through his relationship with Fela. And Tony had a very rich career after Fela. But let's focus on the Africa 70 stuff and what kind of immediately preceded it. Tell us about him.
Tony Allen came to drums pretty late. He was a radio technician before he was a drummer, which kind of came in handy when he could repair the amps for his band on the road. But anyway, he started playing drums when he was 18 and was a complete prodigy. He was into American jazz drumming. He was also just an incredible listener and physical player. One of the most important things for him was to have independence in all four limbs. Michael Veal, who's a professor at Yale and a musician, wrote an autobiography with Tony Allen, interviewed him for something like 250 hours.
And did a Fela book prior to that.
Yeah, I think he liked Afrobeat somehow. The book is really wonderful because you really hear Allen's voice in all of his petty complaints about money, but his cosmic things that he has to say about rhythm too. Soon after he started playing drums, he was a great drummer. He auditioned for Fela in 1964. Before that, he had been playing in cover bands, basically in Lagos, where you had to play waltzes and rumbas and Ghanaian high life hits and rock and roll and funk and everything else. And he just got it all. By the time he started working with Fela, they had a band before Africa 70 that was a Latin high life jazz hybrid called the Kula Lobitos. And that was kind of the rough draft of Africa 70, the great Fela band.
Right. And this is still mid to late 60s. This is right before Fela and his group tours America. This is before they get heavily exposed to James Brown.
Right. There, I mean, there's lots of workshopping going on. In 1969, Fela and the Kula Lobitos come to America. They end up in Los Angeles for a long time. And Fela's girlfriend and the fact that it's 1969 radicalizes him and gets him interested in putting politics into his music, which wasn't that much of a stretch because his mother was also a political leader in Nigeria. But the combination of Fela gearing the music toward politics and Allen learning and watching for the first time, because he'd just been listening to records, learning and watching American jazz drummers gives you this magical combination. I want to read you a kind of a long quote from Michael Veal book. Here's what says. He says, I had developed the drumming concept for Afrobeat from many things that I heard while I was growing up. It was a fusion of beats and patterns. There was high life. There was local Yoruba music like Apala and Sakara. There was jazz, and there was Western popular music like funk and R&B. There was Atilogwu, which is an Igbo dance from the east of Nigeria. There was also some of the traditional music from Ghana that you could hear in the fishing villages in Lagos in the early days, like Kapan Logo and Agbazda. And Agbadza. Now, I don't know what half of these things are, but he was thinking, you know, this isn't some thing that popped out of his head in a psychedelic haze. He was hearing all of these traditions and consciously using them. But the way he consciously used them was like no dance music drummer I can think of. He used them like a jazz drummer, which was, it was always improvisatory. Most dance music drummers lock into a beat and push you around the dance floor. And Allen did something else. Allen was reacting to everything. He was bouncing off the horns. He was bouncing off the voices. He was bouncing off the guitar and the bass. He had an advantage in Afrobeat because There were things in the band like shakers and claves playing a steady beat. And if you listen to an Afrobeat band, the guitar and the bass are really locked into the riff. I mean, their job is just to hit that groove and hit that groove and hit that groove. It's very repetitive. Hello, Kraftwerk.
Right. We're getting there. We're getting there. And there's an interesting quote also that I believe was in your obituary from Martin Perna from Antibalas, saying that a lot of what Tony Allen did, even though it was so, there was so much variation in it, it could be perhaps even more steady as an experience than a more conventional four on the floor, steady drum pattern.
Yeah, it was hypnotic. It drew you in. Another thing he told me that I didn't have room for in the obit was Alan was the musical director of the band. During the 6-hour sets, they would play 4 nights a week at the Shrine in Lagos. And boy, I wish I'd ever been there for one of those.
Whew.
He would lead the band for the first hour on his own before Fela came on stage. So we're talking a lot of extended hypnotic, we are going to dance all night and this is a marathon. So Afrobeat is not like frenetic. It's very, it's mid-tempo, it's serious, it's somber. It's not drum and bass.
No, no. It, you know, a sort of very imperfect analogy I always felt. I felt that there was a lot of consonance between Afrobeat and roots reggae, like in terms of pacing and in terms of sometimes in terms of content. But the complexities, rhythmic complexities that are going on from Tony Allen and in the early Africa 70 stuff is obviously kind of in an ecosystem of its own. I wonder if we should play like a representative section of a song from the early Africa 70 period.
Let's play the total classic Fela song, which is Zombie.
Oof, unstoppable. I should also say, do you remember, I wish I could remember what year this was. I want to say it was like mid-2000s when MCA just did like the complete Fela reissue set where they just put out 50 Fela records on CD. Do you have any memory of this?
Yeah, I do. And then Knitting Factory Records actually came out with its own reissues later too.
I remember getting those boxes and just being so happy. It's like, that was back when you would get big boxes from record labels and be excited. And I just remember being so thrilled to have those. Anyway.
So you're like Brian Eno in 1977, having his mind blown by Afrobeat. And then.
I was. I mean, it was just like, it was just gorging. You know, I was so excited to hear, because some of it I had heard before, but so much of it I hadn't heard. So it was just like a great, great opportunity.
And so much of it is good.
Yeah, exactly.
And the thing is, I mean, those were studio recordings, so they couldn't go past 15 minutes, pretty much on an album side. You have to wonder what it sounded like at the Shrine if that thing went for 30 minutes or 45 minutes or an hour, and you know how much bubbled up inside that music.
Yeah, I wish there was. I mean, maybe there is. Who knows? Like a Lagos taper who had some Shrine recordings that are going to get unearthed. Maybe the Kuti family is sitting on them. Let's get into Zombie. And like, when I say get into Zombie, I mean get into Zombie. Go and keep. Go and die. Go and quench. Put up all the verse. Go and quench. Go and kill. Go and die. Put up all the verse. Go and die. Go and quench.
One of the things Martine Perna of Anta Balas also told me was that Tony Allen was directing where the group was going. So what he would do was he would play a little bit of the horn sharp to cue the horns to come back in. So he would play that melodically on his tom-toms and the horns suddenly snap to attention and there they are playing after the 20-minute saxophone solo. So he was guiding the band. He was, you know, not only at its foundation, but he was also steering it.
How do you feel like Africa 70 developed over the course of the 70s? And what kind of dialogue was it having with other musics in other cities, in other countries, in other continents?
You know, from playing in the cover bands, they had already soaked up a lot of stuff. I suspect that being in the United States in 1969, you were hearing a lot of James Brown. And
yeah.
And James Brown is definitely part of what's going on in the Great Africa 70s records. You know, that scratchy rhythm guitar, that sort of high, sharp rhythm guitar is definitely by way of James Brown. They got deeper and deeper into their own kind of funk, though. We should play Question Jam Answer, which is another Fela song. I can't figure this out. I mean, you know, I cannot analyze this. It's like...
Okay.
One of the things Alan said in his book was when he would play with rock musicians and Western musicians later, he's like, sometimes they have trouble figuring out where the one is. And I feel their pain in this song.
Oh, man. Oh, that's funny. Okay, let's listen a little bit of that.
When question to format, question goes that to run. When answer to format, answer grown up to run. When answer jump question for road, another thing go shallow. Where you mash my leg for ground? You know, see my leg for road. Why you mash my leg for ground? You know, see my leg for road.
Let's pivot, because we now have set the table with Tony Allen. Let's jump up to Dusseldorf. As Fela and Tony Allen are building Afrobeat from a bunch of different parts and making it into its own sound and ideology, something parallel is happening up in Germany. Everything that's organic and hand-played and textured about Afrobeat has a complete opposite going on with Kraftwerk. Let's talk about Kraftwerk and Florian Schneider and Rolf Huter, Florian, who just passed away. But let's talk about the Kraftwerk idea and where did it come from and how did it manifest?
Kraftwerk's idea was, let's stop imitating American rock and roll. Let's find our own European Teutonic heritage to the point of self-caricature. I mean, there's a very dry sense of humor that runs through all of Kraftwerk. I mean, they're not neo-Nazis. They're very aware of who they are, but they wanted something that was theirs that wasn't the Beatles trying to play Little Richard. You know, they wanted something different and their own. And Kraftwerk came out of this late 60s psychedelic, crazy, hippie era in German music called cosmic. And they discovered minimalism and they discovered jamming and they discovered little percussion instruments from around the world. And the first Kraftwerk albums, I should say Kraftwerk, but I have to think about
it. Yeah, it's okay.
Well, part of the deal was they gave their band a German name. Kraftwerk means power plant. And for a German band in the late 60s to give itself a German name instead of trying to be an English language band was a big statement. But anyway, their early albums are these wacky, long jams that are also already very repetitive and minimalistic. Kraftwerk has reissued its catalog starting in 1974 with Autobahn. Right. And there are albums before them that they have disowned, but I don't know why they disown them. But we should play Ruckzuck, which means in a flash. And Florian is playing the instrument he later gave up. He's playing the flute. And the flute is this minimalistic rhythm instrument. But if you listen to Ruckzuck, you can already hear Trans-Europe Express in it.
Let's get into a little Ruckzuck. Really thought about this, strictly speaking, prior to talking to you, but it's interesting how the germ of Afrobeat and the germ of Kraftwerk is sort of a reaction to embracing of moving beyond American influence and sort of saying, how can I take the best parts of this and build it into something that's particular to where I'm from? That feels like maybe a common thread between these two artists and scenes.
Well, I actually think if you want to just go totally macro, this happens all the time in music. There's a phase where some cool thing comes from somewhere else. You imitate it for a while, and then either it ruins you and everybody in the world is trying to imitate Jamaican reggae, or you take it over and give it your local cultural convolution. As in Afrobeat taking over James Brown.
Yes.
Musicians are the opposite of purists. They go through the imitative phase, and the geniuses then figure out how to give it local roots.
We should get to Autobahn. Again, we can't really play 7-minute parts of these songs, but like Kraftwerk makes very long music. Africa 70 was making very long songs. Like, these are not sort of radio focused, have to be printed on a 7-inch single, 3.5-minute songs. Like, these are still kind of carrying some of the residue of the sprawl of the 60s, both of these artists.
Right.
You did a great playlist with all the sort of essential Kraftwerk songs. Autobahn is obviously where you really start to hear the pivot at its full power. And we should listen to part of Autobahn, although it's a little unfair because no matter which part of Autobahn we play, we're not going to give you the full 22-minute experience. Like, you should take a warm bath and like put on Autobahn.
Get in your car.
Yeah, that's true.
Get in your car and especially find now, drive down a deserted highway.
Real talk. So maybe Kraftwerk is an optimal choir band. So here's a little bit of Autobahn and just imagine the remaining 21.5 minutes. So this is 1974. What's happening now? What did Kraftwerk let go of, and what did they lean into?
They let go of drums. This is Kraftwerk's first breach with the past. It's like, we are daring to be dinky. We are making drum sounds that are not drum sounds, but are like basically little pieces of white noise. And it's the mid-70s, you know? Fleetwood Mac is recording. Progressive rock bands are recording. You have like people who are, you know, taking 3 days in the studio to get a drum sound. And Kraftwerk is saying, tss, tss. So that's the first thing they're doing. Schneider's flute is actually still in parts of Autobahn, but they're mostly using synthesizers. And Schneider's role in the group, as Hooter said, was to be the sound fetishist. He was the guy who was thinking about the sounds you made. And, you know, back in the fabulous 70s, it was not easy to get a sound out of a synthesizer. You couldn't take your phone out of your pocket and have a software synthesizer in your phone. You had to decide the attack, decay, sustain, release curve of the sound you wanted. And they were working on some, you know, really primitive, clunky, modular synthesizers. So each sound they made had to be chosen. And each part of the arrangement had to be chosen. So did you want to sound like a rock band with bass, drums, guitar, keyboards, whatever? Did you want to play chords? Or did you want to make these sounds that only synthesizers could make? I mean, one of the things about Autobahn, one of the things that makes it so zen hermetic is that the notes sustain beyond what your breath can do. So you're sealed into this long, zooming experience that is inhuman, that's not tied to what your limbs or your lungs can do.
And it's worth emphasizing again how novel this was from a sonic perspective and from an aesthetic perspective at the time. We kind of take for granted the sort of fundamental cyborgian nature of pop music right now. Like, we understand that most vocals are run through some kind of digital processing. We understand that there is a kind of very fruitful back and forth between technology and organic. We're kind of past, well, at least most of us are past being like, oh, the only good music is the music that's organic and, you know, played on an acoustic instrument without any technological interference.
Like, we're except past the microphone. Those things.
Right. Yes, true. Shouts to my snowball. So by and large, we're past those conversations. But in the early 70s, there was still something very radical about the people in Kraftwerk choosing to perform as, present as something other than human.
Well, correct? Why would you play these dinky little restricted narrow sounds when you had the beauty of an acoustic guitar or a piano?
I don't know her. That's how I feel about that, but that's all right.
But it's very Puritan in a way. It's very austere and renunciatory. It's like a vow of no resonance. You know, a vow of silence. It's like, let's use these dinky sounds. I have to brag a little. I saw Kraftwerk in 1978.
Oh, how'd you save that until now? You got to lead with that.
Well, they played a club in Boston called Paul's Mall, which was about the size of the Bowery Ballroom, maybe, or smaller.
Okay.
And there are these four guys on stage doing total deadpan, and it's vague, and someone is going to find a photo that's going to completely disprove me. But I think it was two of them on keyboards and two of them on what looked like drum pads. And okay. My memory is that the drumsticks they were using, they looked like chopsticks wrapped in tin foil, you know, and they're going. Okay. And it's like, why would you be this dinky? And then you realize that this is such a radical choice.
I mean, you'd been seeing bands for quite some time at that point. Had you seen any bands like that?
Were there any bands like that?
I think it was only them.
You know, yeah. I saw Mahavishnu Orchestra like 3 or 4 years earlier. It's like the opposite. Kraftwerk was really pushing the envelope of weirdness. They were being such a caricature of being Germans, you know.
Yeah.
The uniforms, the robotic aspect. I think they were having a lot of fun.
I'm sorry, guys. I don't mean to interrupt, but I just wanted to share a quick story. I saw them in 1981 at the Ritz.
Yeah.
And it was crazy because they had robots for the first hour of the concert. They weren't even on stage. They just had robots on stage, half robots, fire. Basically these mannequin tops on metal poles. And that was the whole show. And the crowd went absolutely wild.
Okay, so we have to play We Are the Robots.
To Pedro's point, you know, Kraftwerk's playing the Ritz. Partially, they're popular, but also Kraftwerk was being paid attention to by some other people in New York, you know, right? We know Trans-Europe Express ends up on Planet Rock, and a lot of what Kraftwerk is doing ends up spilling over into the electro-influenced early hip-hop scene and sound, Bambata, etc. So who else was listening to Kraftwerk, and also who was listening to Africa 70 at that point?
Well, late 70s, everybody in Europe was listening to Kraftwerk. I mean, you had all of the synth pop, you had Gary Numan, you had David Bowie has a song called V2 Schneider, named after Florian Schneider. Everybody in Europe who was wanting to make European music, realizing they could never play the blues, was listening to Kraftwerk. The early 80s were synth pop heaven, Soft Cell, Human League. Everybody. It was different from the late 70s when the contrast was punk or disco or Fleetwood Mac. Disco also had a repetitive, hypnotic feel to it, why disco would gravitate to electro. But the other stuff was in direct contrast. By the early 80s, Kraftwerk were already recognized as the prophets they were.
To what degree was Africa 70 understood or followed outside of Nigeria?
That was more on the arty side. The one glaring exception being Brian Eno brings Fela to Talking Heads and they make Remain in Light and Speaking in Tongues. I forget which track it was, but Eno said, the reason that track is so interesting is I couldn't find the one.
People tell on themselves all the time. Just an important thing to remember. People will be telling on themselves.
Talking Heads and arty New Yorkers who were inventing punk funk, short-lived but beautiful, were listening to this stuff. But it was more on the arty side. I mean, Kraftwerk was really infiltrating pop. And I mean, because if you're not Tony Allen, you can't play like that. So it's harder. Right. I mean, it's a lot easier to go than it is to start rumbling across the tom-toms and playing the hi-hats and cueing the horns like Tony Allen.
I actually do want to circle back to Tony Allen about the specificity of the drum playing, the complexity of it. You know, you say it's hard to emulate, and like undoubtedly that's true. The idea of four parts, four independent parts, but all kind of like orbiting a similar axis, is that not a hallmark of jazz? Is that not something that comes up in other musical contexts?
That is great jazz drumming. And he really studied. He studied Tony Williams. He studied Philly Joe Jones. He studied Art Blakey. But you're not driving a dance band for 6 hours as a jazz drummer. One of the other things he talked about in the book was in 1969 in Los Angeles, he ran into a jazz drummer named Frank Butler. And Butler said, "Learn to play on pillows. Play with such a light touch that your sticks will bounce off the pillow." So he learned to play really softly and subtly, which is a good thing to do if you're playing for 6 hours a night, but also gives you all kinds of nuances. The other thing, he was very proud that he concentrated on the hi-hat. I mean, the hi-hat is that little thing that goes ch-ch-ch. Most African drummers were ignoring it. Jazz drummers were using it, but often just as a timekeeper. And he really brought out the nuance. He left Fela in 1978 because Fela wasn't paying him. I think he played one more song with Fela in the studio. They actually remained fairly close, but it did not go back to working together. But because there's so much going on in Africa 70, you can hear Alan himself better outside the band. Let's try one of his solo albums. Let's try Moving On, where you can really hear what's going on.
Moving on.
Make you to listen to my music. Make you to listen to my music. I don't do many, many, oh yeah. But make you to listen. Because music will not get into me. Make I tell you.
I guess the last thing I want to talk about, and if I'm reaching, you should just tell me I'm reaching. But I wonder, you know, we've spent a lot of time talking about the ways in which the music that was made by these two artists was very different and sort of addressing different source material, different social concerns, different musical frameworks. Do you think that there is a reason that they happened at the same time? Is there something that was going on in the 70s that created the same opportunity for both of these things to thrive? And do you hear any consonances between what Florian and Tony were doing?
What do you mean besides the marijuana?
I don't know anything about that. Is that a drug?
No, it's a medicinal herb.
It's a plug-in.
There you go. No, it probably is.
Yeah.
Look up your VSTs, kids. Well, I mean, part of it was the explosion of 60s ideas and global interpenetration and politics, and then the reaction to it. I mean, I hear Kraftwerk as a renunciation of excess. We are limiting ourselves to what we can do here and making the most of it. Because Kraftwerk, once everybody caught up with them, they had a lot more difficulty distinguishing themselves from the pack. And by the time they did their Tour de France album, a lot of bands were sounding like them. And they were using a lot of the same digital synthesizers and things were easier to do. And by then, Kraftwerk were more part of the flow of popular music. They weren't a revolution anymore. Meanwhile, Tony Allen, he leaves Fela, he eventually leaves Africa and moves to Europe, to France, and starts working with all kinds of people. He recorded with the techno guy, Jeff Mills, who of course would definitely know what Kraftwerk was about. Damon Albarn loved Afrobeat and got Allen as his drummer whenever he could. He cross-pollinated, but you could still hear that sort of muscle and finesse of Afrobeat in everything he did. Gorillaz, after Allen died, like a few days later, released a new song with Tony Allen called How Far.
Yeah, with Skepta on it.
Yeah. Allen got into electronics pretty early. He had been trying to apparently convince Fela to put some synthesizers into the band, and Fela resisted. But when he first started recording on his own in the 80s, he made this pretty cool album called NEPA, named after the Nigerian Electric Power Authority, which the lyrics of the song go, "Never expect power always," because apparently the Nigerian Electric Power Authority was not exactly reliable. But he experimented a lot in his later years with drums, electronics, dub, all these other things that would make things further complicated. But it always did come down to those four independent limbs for Tony Allen. And for Kraftwerk, it was just the opposite. It was into the abstraction, into the things that humans couldn't do. So I think you basically have, it's still an organic versus inorganic contrast, but Allen was looking toward the inorganic because he wanted that in his palette too.
Kraftwerk is committed to the ideology, and Tony Allen's ideology is no ideology. It's embracing everything. Let's go out with that Gorillaz song with Skepta and Tony Allen, and that is How Far. JP, always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure. Oh yeah.
For the money, give a change to your mother. Change them sheets, you got stains on the cover. Better look sharp, like your face on the cover.
This year, a very important public figure turns 80. He sent us his wish for his birthday.
My wish is for everyone to practice wildfire safety, because only you can prevent wildfires.
That sounds easy enough. Bet you don't know who it is. Nah, of course you do. It's Smokey Bear. Let's all make sure Smokey's wish comes true by learning his wildfire prevention tips at SmokeyBear.com. Because Smokey Bear lives within us all. Brought to you by the USDA Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at the New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at the New York Times work on every day, to give you clarity and perspective, and above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to the New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
We are back, part two of the Tony Allen, Florian Schneider Memorial Popcast. JP was just with us. New JP is with us now. Joseph Patel is here. What's good, man?
How you doing, man?
I am well. I'm blessed to have you. For those who don't know, let me just give a quick history lesson. We've already had a lot of history on this episode, but let me give you a little personal history lesson. So I started writing professionally in 96, 97 while I was still in school. The person who was doing the writing that I wanted to do, the person who I was looking at and said, I can do what that person does, that's what I want to do, is this person who's on podcast right now. Joseph, sorry, I'm just going to call you Joey. I've known you too long. Joey, FKA Jazzbo, was writing in The Herb and in The Source and all these publications covering the exact stuff that I cared about. And it made me think that I could do it too. So I'm always grateful for Joey's existence and for his influence and, of course, for his friendship over the decades since. It is exciting to have an opportunity to have him on podcast. So, number one, shouts to you.
I appreciate that. That was a very sweet intro.
It's all facts. This is just facts only.
I appreciate on podcast. That.
Right now, so Joey doesn't really write anymore, works on television projects, film projects. You may know Contact High, which started as a book by Vicky Toback. That was a collection of hip-hop photographs. It has turned into a museum exhibition. It is going to turn into a full documentary. And Joey is also the producer of a forthcoming film Questlove is directing. It's about Black Woodstock, which was a series of concerts. What year was it?
1969, the Harlem Cultural Festival.
Post-pandemic, I would imagine. So taking those the kind of skills and the knowledge base that made him such an appealing writer to me, and now applying it out, painting the rest of the world with it. So
I should also flip that around and say the reason I got out of writing is because of you.
Oh, because Lord.
Because I realized that I could not do it nearly as well or as passionately as you did. And I felt I needed to find something else to do.
Damn. And now look at me. I'm just a podcaster. Good Lord. Let's deep sigh reminisce a little bit.
Okay.
Because one of the things that you did especially well, that I'm actually not sure that I ever fully dove into or ever felt as intensely as you did. You were always interested in where hip hop was getting its musical cues from, what musical legacies it was pulling from. I felt like I certainly early on and even later,
I'm excited about the currentness of it, the kind of sui generis evolution, the fact that 6 months from now is going to be different from right now. I've always been seeking that stuff out. You always had a very good ear for hearing what it was taking from the past. So when I thought about the influence of Kraftwerk, the influence of Tony Allen and Africa 70, I thought about that era of music writing and of hip hop writing, and immediately was like, well, Joey will know. Joey will understand how to tell that part of the story. So pick one, start with one of them, and your call, dealer's choice. And let's kind of carry it through post 1970s, post early 80s.
Probably Kraftwerk is the easiest one to start with. It's funny when you asked me to be on this podcast, I thought about Florian and Tony, and you know, it's rare. There's not a lot of people in the world that have changed music, the direction of music, with their just sheer existence and curiosity and creativity. And here we have two of them who sort of came of age around the same time and died within days of each other. And that is really one of those cosmic things that really makes you take a step back and really appreciate living in this time right now, right? Kraftwerk is probably the most influential group in the history of music.
I don't want to get any emails from Beatles fans. I don't want to get any no emails. This is an opinion. This is an opinion, but it's a big fact opinion. Go in.
With Kraftwerk, really, their influence is sort of twofold. One is the music they were making, and then two is the gear on which they were making that music.
Yes.
Right? And I think, for me, the Kraftwerk samples in Planet Rock is where you can draw the direct line between hip-hop and what Florian and company were doing.
In the first segment, we did not play Planet Rock. So we should play just a bit of Planet Rock, and it will be eminently clear the line between Trans-Europe Express and what Bambaataa was doing.
I first heard Kraftwerk around the same time I heard Planet Rock. And I think it was because when you were listening to the radio at the time, a lot of DJs were playing both. You know, I remember growing up listening, I believe it was KMEL, and there was a late night, Friday night mix hour, and the DJ played Planet Rock and played a lot of the samples in which were used in Planet Rock. And I remember hearing Kraftwerk thinking that one part that he's isolated from that song, Trans-Europe Express, is so incredible to me. And a couple of years later, you hear it again with the LA Dream Team, and you've heard iterations of that same rhythm and melody in the years ever since. And so Kraftwerk, when you first hear it, it's unlike anything you've ever heard before. So I think the original question you asked, which is, for me, hip hop was always as much about what was being made in the current climate and whenever I was listening to it, but also where it came from, right? The samples, sample culture, beat digging, that was all really interesting to me because that was really a gateway into getting into more music, more great music.
There is this very, very clear line, obviously, the influence of electro on early hip hop, the persistent influence, especially in the West Coast, you know, like up through World Class Wrecking Crew, like really into, you know, Egyptian Lover, you know, mid-80s stuff is still kind of grappling very, very directly with what Kraftwerk did. And I can't remember, you know, I'm sure I've seen like 5 interviews to this effect with different people over the years, but there was this sense, I think, with hip hop producers from the 80s, where they're looking at these German guys dressed like machines, not moving on stage, and being like, huh, that's like so anti-funk that it's actually funky. Like it's so opposite of everything else that it's actually iteratively a new way of thinking about funk.
It's digital funk, right? And it's like the thing that Kraftwerk were able to do is make soulful, funky music that had beat and rhythm and could rock a party. And I think the early hip hop
creators, that's all that mattered, right? That's the mindset, is I can find a funky break in a rock song. I could find soul in this digital, trancy 25-minute song from Germany. Like, I think that's part of the beauty of hip-hop, is being able to find the things they connect with, and then also to flip them into something that works for them now. And Kraftwerk, you know, again, it wasn't just the music, it was just the sort of imagination that they had. And the machines that they were making are the same machines, like the machines that made Trans-Europe Express, and even, you know, I would argue, I'm not a studio nerd, so I don't know this for a fact, but even Radioactivity and Autobahn are probably similar to the instruments, to the machines that are making hip-hop. And I think Kraftwerk had patented a drum machine very early on in their career. These are the things and the tools that are available to the early hip hop producers 12 years later. So I think there's a little connection, not only musically, but also from a technology standpoint as well.
I hadn't really thought about it in pure technological terms, but, you know, we take for granted now, like if you're interested in making music, you know, you go to the Guitar Center or whatever, and there's 200 synthesizers, 500 synthesizers, drum machines, mixers, samplers, there's untold options. But in the 70s, you did not have that. You had a very narrow palette of things to choose from. And then what you could do is you could freak them in unexpected ways.
And also, people who were making hip hop didn't have access to the latest technology. Right? It was hand-me-down technology. It was, what can we do with this thing that we have, the only thing that we have? And I think that's sort of part of the creative DNA of what hip-hop is.
Absolutely. So given that Kraftwerk was about like as much the antithesis of what you would think of for hip-hop source material, let's sort of pivot and talk about Tony Allen and Fela and Africa 70. When does that stuff start to get picked up on and kind of like put back into the feed cycle?
Let me just take a step back, because I want to say one other thing about Kraftwerk, which is at the same time that they are influencing and inspiring this sort of wave of hip hop from Bambaataa on through electro hip hop and even some of the stuff coming out of Miami. At the same time,
shout out Dave Tompkins.
Yeah, that same music, the same songs even, are influencing and watering the seeds in Detroit for Detroit techno.
Oh, absolutely.
And also new wave, right? Like Computer World from Kraftwerk comes out the same time that you're hearing for the first time Depeche Mode and Soft Cell and New Order. And it's amazing to me, and this is why I would argue about Kraftwerk's influence, is they simultaneously are inspiring and influencing multiple genres of music with the same source material. And I don't know where in the history of music you find that.
Totally fair. Okay, now let's pivot a little bit to Tony Allen, Fela, Africa 70. When does that stuff start to make it back kind of into the feedback cycle?
If I have to think off the top of my head, I don't know what as demonstrative an example is of Fela's impact and by proxy, obviously, Tony Allen's impact on hip-hop, the way you would find with Kraftwerk and Bambaataa's Planet Rock. To me, it's real influence, Fela's influence and Tony's influence on hip-hop is twofold. One is, I think, in terms of political, right? Fela, just the act of making the music he made was fighting against sort of Western cultural imperialism and colonialism. And just the existence of the music itself was a sort of f*** you to Western cultural norms, right? And I think hip-hop has a lot of that. I think hip-hop took on that sort of active resistance. The sheer making of hip-hop music is political. But I think in the other way, I think you really start to feel the influence of Afrobeat and Tony Allen's sort of drum patterns and his sort of mode of playing in the production of The Bomb Squad and Public Enemy and De La Soul and Prince Paul, this idea that you could have polyrhythms, that you could have all this stuff layered on top of each other and still have momentum being carried in one direction. And I think, again, you see it later with Outkast and specifically with the Dungeon Family and their style of production. And I believe there was that one Dungeon Family album that was sort of like a group album.
The Crew album, yeah.
Yeah, they actually, it's interesting because they actually have a song that's sort of an homage to Kraftwerk on that album called Trans DF Express. But and just to how Organized Noise produced all the Outkast albums, especially Stankonia, it sounds very similar to me to what you heard with Afrobeat.
Interesting. There's like a little bit of a wink and an ironic nod when the early hip hop producers are pulling from source material like Kraftwerk. There's no irony in, I think, pulling from Fela or Africa 70, but it also feels like a much more low key borrowing. And I wonder if it's because, in essence, the complexity of what Tony Allen was doing is very, very hard to replicate. It's hard to just go to a session drummer and be like, yeah, do this. Right. This like thing with seven different things happening at once. Do that. Just like jump in it. That's hard.
It also doesn't follow the same 4-4 beat pattern that you right that you find in other music you can sample. It's very complicated music. Tony Allen playing with Fela especially, you're talking about songs that are 20, 30, 35 minutes long.
And changing. Like obviously Kraftwerk has long songs, but not really changing in the same way or not as much.
Changing, just vibrant, always driven by Tony Allen's drum patterns underneath that. I mean, I think Tony Allen sort of saw himself as less of a drummer in a strictly musical sense and more of a channeler. There's a quote he said numerous times in various iterations about how he has four limbs and each limb is channeling something else. There's one limb that is channeling American bebop jazz, another limb that's channeling Yoruba music from Nigeria, and this idea that he was sort of channeling all these musical forms into one body. And that's hard to sample.
Right. For all of the kind of creativity and flexibility that sampling affords, there is still the idea of like, I am taking a small piece of this thing. When you take something small, you don't take something complex generally. You take something that's legible. Were you surprised that there wasn't more a Tony Allen or an Afrobeat influence into hip hop, especially when you get post-Native Tongues, you get Soulquarian era, stuff where the politics and the musical texture would maybe be more in alignment?
I think Fela and Tony Allen and Africa 70, it's so singular. I couldn't even imagine. Even Tony Allen tried to replicate it when he left Fela's band for his solo records, and it's not the same, right? It has the same sound, but it doesn't have the same fire. I guess I am surprised because it seems like it would be ripe for that. But I guess when you think about it, is so unique that how could you even try? You know, one of the things I find funny is that it wasn't hip hop that gravitated to Tony Allen after sort of in his later years, because he moved to London and then Paris and spent a lot of time playing in Europe. And it's a series of like white hip hop musicians and or producers who sort of had access to Tony Allen.
Yeah, it's like all of a sudden like, oh, you're just here.
Yeah. And it's like, oh, I see him. I can go see Tony Allen play. And hey, do you want to be on my record? And I get the attraction, right? If you're Damon Albarn, right? Or if you're Dr. L, why wouldn't you want Tony Allen on your album? Why wouldn't you want to play with him? Like it not only lends some authenticity, but it's like, he's a legend. He's going to make you better. I thought it was really funny, right? It's like you started seeing Tony Allen's name pop up on projects in the early 2000s. And some of them are okay. There's a couple of really good moments, and there's a lot of bad
stuff.
There's
some duds. There's some duds.
There's a really interesting project. I think it's 2000 or 2001. A label called Comet Records that had signed Tony Allen to put out his solo work. They gave a bunch of Tony Allen's studio masters to different producers to create songs out of. And they called it the Allen Co. Brotherhood Ensemble. And you had people like Jimmy Tenor and Cinematic Orchestra and all these different like producer.
Oh, yeah, I remember this.
Making songs out of Tony Allen drum patterns. And there's actually some really, really good stuff on there.
Let's listen to something off that. I haven't thought about that record in a long time. What should we listen to off the Allen Co. or Alenco Brotherhood Ensemble?
Because I love Cinematic Orchestra and just mentioned them. Let's listen to Cinematic Orchestra. It does a song called Brotherhood.
Yeah, shouts to Cinematic Orchestra. I always held on to my Cinematic Orchestra vinyl. In my many vinyl purges, I've always held on to the Cinematic Orchestra vinyl. So, all right, Tony Allen, Cinematic Orchestra, let's go. kind of logical fusion point between the two threads of this episode, right? Which is to say the highly organic and the highly digital, or the organic masking is digital. There is a point where Tony Allen makes a record with Jeff Mills.
Yeah.
So that to me feels like perhaps a logical conclusion point for this entire conversation. I mean, here is Jeff Mills, crucial Detroit techno innovator, clearly an inheritor genre-wise of the work that Kraftwerk had done. Here's Tony Allen still sounding like Tony Allen, and the two kind of come together for this project. I'll be honest, I don't love everything on this record, but it's the most literal statement that these two worlds can coexist, not just kind of run in parallel.
That collaboration between the two of them, I think, is one of those things that sounds better on paper than it does in practice. I think there's maybe each of them are too deferential to each other to actually commit to something. Yes,
that's real. That's real.
And there's, I think the first song on that album is called Locked and Loaded. And that song is tremendous. To me, that's a tremendous synergy of those two talents, Jeff Mills and Tony Allen. But actually four years before that, I think is where these strands really come together, is Tony Allen joins the Moritz von Oswald trio. And Moritz von Oswald, if you're looking for sort of like a next generation Florian Schneider, he's essentially it. And Tony Allen joins his trio and does a bunch of live shows. And I think they released a live record or two. But that album, that collaboration is incredible. Moritz, I think, is a genius. And Tony's presence in the band makes it so much better. And you can see it. There's some YouTube live recordings. You can see Moritz just really feeding off of what Tony is giving him. But it's in the same vein where you have this sort of Afrobeat strand and this Detroit techno, Berlin techno strand inspired directly by Kraftwerk coming together in a natural meeting point.
So let's go out with something from this Moritz and Tony period. What do you want to go to?
Sounding Lines is the album I think that they worked on together.
All right, let's get into a little something from Sounding Lines by the Moritz von Oswald trio. Joey, a pleasure, an honor, a thrill.
I had good fun. Thank you.
Before we go this week, you know, on last week's episode, as a couple of you noticed, we did not do JC Cribbs. It occurred to Pedro and I right before the end of our recording. But to be honest, the energy of the conversation about Fiona with Jen and Lindsay, I just felt like let's let that cook live on its own. All good. But we are back. And we're going to close out this week with another JC Cribbs. And since we are on the subject of people who are influential, who have passed away, my office has become something of a repository for some of my merch and various ephemera that I have collected over the years. And I'm looking at a couple of things that I want to talk about. First, I'm looking at a Mac Dre t-shirt. I actually got this Mac Dre t-shirt not that long ago. I found it in a secondhand store in DC. Great Mac Dre t-shirt, very, very loud. It's got the school bus on it. He's doing a real fizz face. It's a very, very strong Mac Dre t-shirt. And then behind me, I have a Selena t-shirt. And now you might think like, ah, sure, everybody's got a Selena t-shirt. And like, undoubtedly, that's true. Plenty of people do. I do want to say I've had this Selena t-shirt for many, many, many years. I am fairly certain I got it at ProCell. Shouts to Brian. In the pre-Selena t-shirt rage. And I will say that there's a very funny story associated with this t-shirt that involves Drake that I will not tell you. However, that's a real thing. So I have those two things, and those are both hanging up in places where I can see them, and they make me smile when I look at them. The final thing that I want to talk about is something that I don't read enough. But I do have here, and I'm grateful to have them. So I have two letters here from 2004. And these are letters from jail from Pimp C of UGK. Pimp C, as you know, died in the mid-2000s. This is when he was in jail and I was writing about UGK. And eventually later I did, I believe it was the first Pimp C story or first Pimp C interview after he got out of jail. Julia Beverly might want to fact check me on that. I'm not sure, but I think so. But here are two letters from Pimp C. You know, they're handwritten. These are not friend letters. These are interview letters, but we did develop a rapport and I did get to spend some time with him down in Port Arthur after he got out of jail. You pick up a lot of things along the way when you do work like this, but these are very special to me. UGK is very important to me. Bun B is very important to me. And these letters are extremely special and I am grateful and proud to have them. And I keep them in my office. They had been sort of like bumping around in various boxes, but about a year ago, I came across them and I said, oh, I can't lose sight of these. I can't not know where these are. So I put them in my office. I have them on one of the bookshelves, one of the hip-hop book bookshelves, of which there are many. And every now and again, I just pick them off the shelf and kind of take a read of them. That's our show for this week. Thank you to John Pareles. Thank you to Joey Patel. Listen to every podcast ever, nytimes.com/podcast. Email us at podcast@nytimes.com with any questions or any thoughts. Also, of course, the Facebook group, as ever, is jumping. And I want to shout out, I was looking on the Facebook group last night, and I knew that this recording was happening today. And I looked on the Facebook group last night, and what do I see? Max posts a comment, RIP Florian, one half of the greatest duo in electronic music. And then the reply comes from someone named Jordan Daniel Haar. Jordan, what's good? He says, we need a dual Tony Allen Florian memorial podcast. And I was like, if only you knew, man, if only you knew. Great minds think alike. I'm glad to see that your brain went where my brain went, and I hope you enjoyed this episode. So anyway, get back on. If you want to see your wildest podcast dreams incepted, get on the podcast Facebook group, post something. You never know what it might align with. Subscribe to podcast anywhere you get your audio content. That would be Apple, Stitcher, Google Play, iHeart, Spotify, etc. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Head Separate Media. We'll be back next week. And as I'm leaving you, I want to leave you with an important Pimp C record. Pimp C, as you know, produced all the important UGK records. You know that sound. You know that signature sound. And really, you can throw a dart at anything from those early records, especially. And it's just going to be a banger and also like just an incredibly emotional song. But let's just play one of the hits, one of the obvious ones. You know this record. This is UGK, front, back, side to side. RIP Pimp C.
Front and back, and side to side. Never let whole ass look at pride.
Back, front and back, and side to side. Back, front and back, and side to side. Back, front and back, and side to side.
Never let whole ass look at pride.
I got a 64 Chevy in my yard. A white drop top, pearl paint job is hard. White plush inside, nothing robe is fresh. Triple gold, double A Dayton's is the best. I got them 16 switches like Drake. Cause where I'm from, nothing, that's what everybody.